This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 29th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The number of anthrax cases rises to 8 in the U.S., but is the enemy from abroad or right under our noses? The Bush administration is pushed to send in the ground troops in the war against terrorism. And has Middle East violence spiraled into aimless chaos, or is there still an agenda? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Another postal worker has come down with the most deadly form of anthrax. Jeff Brady reports from New York.
A spokeswoman from the New Jersey Health Department says the condition of the woman who sorted mail in Hamilton Township, New Jersey, was improving at Virtue Memorial Hospital. Another person suspected of having inhalation anthrax at that facility is not confirmed. The other confirmed cases include 2 in Florida, 3 in New York, and 5 in Washington, D.C. So far, about 10,000 postal workers are taking antibiotics to ward off the biological threat. Those who have contracted inhalation anthrax, an editor at a tabloid newspaper in Florida, and 2 postal workers in Washington have died. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
The world is meeting in Morocco to work out the details for a global plan hoping to minimize greenhouse gases and stave off global warming without U.S. participation. Kata Mester explains.
Talks began today in Marrakesh, Morocco, to resuscitate the Kyoto Protocol, a treaty rejected by the United States last March, geared towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions responsible for global warming. Over the next 2 weeks, 150 countries will establish regulations to measure greenhouse gas reductions and create a penalty system for countries that do not meet specified goals. The United States, accused of being the leading contributor of greenhouse gases, claims that the Kyoto Protocol will unfairly damage the American economy. As the Bush administration pushes for a voluntary reduction in greenhouse gases, critics argue that the bombing campaign in Afghanistan illustrates the United States' hollow commitment to environmental issues. Emissions from a banned fire suppressant named Halon 1301, reintroduced into fuel for F-16 fighter jets, has been proven to punch holes into the ozone layer. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Kata Mester.
The Panamanian government has put about 70 journalists on trial for doing their jobs. Laws held over from Panama's dictatorship past are being used by a government that is losing popular confidence and has increasing reports of corruption. Mary Lynn Smith, a spokesperson with the Committee to Protect Journalists, says that the current government promised to remove many of the laws a long time ago.
President Moscoso has, on various occasions, promised that she would repeal the Panama's gag laws. And even though she has eliminated some of the most notorious provisions of those gag laws, the government she has not complied with his promise at all. On the contrary, various people of the government, including the president herself, are prosecuting journalists.
Journalists who are seeing the most jail time are being heavily prosecuted for offending the honor of public officials. The editor-in-chief for El Panama America says journalists are now afraid to rigorously pursue government corruption. She said, what is worth more, a coward who is working or a hero in jail? And finally, city-owned Brackenridge Hospital in Austin, Texas, will not give out emergency contraceptives to rape victims because it violates the principles of the hospital's manager, the Catholic Church. City officials were reportedly stunned by the decision of Seton Healthcare on Thursday night, but there are currently no plans to find another management group. Hannah Rittering, president of the NOW chapter in Austin, Texas, says it will particularly affect poor women.
And the city council apparently is committed to continuing full reproductive services for poor women in Austin. How to go about doing that after they've handed the public hospital over on a platter to the Catholic Church 6 years ago is a whole different question.
The Catholic Church has been routinely buying and or managing hospitals around the country. Church doctrine quickly becomes hospital policy by denying any type of contraception, abortion procedures, or any other measures that would hasten death, even when requested by the patient or their designees. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the nation's eighth case of inhalation anthrax today in a New Jersey postal worker. That brings the total number of anthrax cases, both skin and pulmonary, to 13 since the attacks began. Anthrax spores have been found in 18 locations in Washington, including an off-site office that handles mail for the Justice Department. The contaminated spots include a building which handles mail for the U.S. Supreme Court and some congressional buildings on Capitol Hill. The attacks outside of Washington have targeted at least one politically controversial site. Planned Parenthood centers and abortion providers have received 110 anthrax hoax letters in the last few weeks. And an envelope containing a white powder received at one center in Florida tested positive for anthrax. However, it's still not clear whether the more well-known anthrax letters sent to the U.S. government and the media are the work of domestic or foreign bioterrorists. Certain elements of the racist right in the U.S. have had an intense interest in biological weapons for years. Lee Robartes takes a look at those connections and the impact of the World Trade Center attacks on the far right. From Spokane, Washington, Lee Robartes files this report.
The truth is the people of European descent are, in fact, the actual Hebrews. They are the Hebrews mentioned in the Bible.
Microbiologist Larry Wayne Harris is a former member of the Aryan Nations who has appeared on CNN more than a dozen times since September 11th, at times billed simply as an expert on bioterrorism.
There's a massive international black market in biological weapons. Right now, you know, for the price of a Cadillac, you can buy enough militarized anthrax take out a city.
Harris was convicted of wire fraud in 1997 for receiving three vials of bubonic plague at his home in Ohio. Possessing the agents themselves was not a crime. He was also accused of possessing anthrax in 1998, but charges were dropped when military labs said he only possessed anthrax vaccine. Harris says he was merely doing research for the biological warfare defense kits he sells. He scoffs at the idea that the far right would promote attacks on U.S. targets.
There is no point, because the Muslims will do it for us. There is no point for a patriot group or whatever to try to develop biological weapons. First off, they do not have the technology. There's not that many bioweaponeers in North America, okay? They don't have the technology. They don't have the training, anything of this. They don't have any of that. And if they tried it without years of experience, the only thing they're going to do is kill themselves.
However, Right Watchers say Harris's book, A Civil Defense Manual for Biological Attacks, can also be read as a how-to manual for biological warfare, something he denies.
The fact is, anyone who wanted to engage in bacteriological terror could use his book as a source book. So, you know, it's a difference between what he meant to do and what other people with ill intent could use of it, and it's a scary book from that perspective.
Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates has been a Right Watcher for more than 20 years. Berlay says Harris's chief characteristic is that he's a braggart and that he's not a bioterrorism expert nor an appropriate poster boy for the possibility that the right might be involved in bioterrorism plots. Berlay says, we already know that one sector of the right, the Christian right, is involved with sending at least hoax anthrax letters. 110 abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood offices recently received envelopes containing white powder. One of the mailings sent to an office in Florida tested positive for anthrax.
And there's a history, especially on the neo-Nazi right, of some of these groups acquiring things like cyanide, like other toxic materials that might be used as weapons. And so it's not an impossibility at all. Plus, some of the most extreme neo-Nazi groups around the issue of both disliking the U.S. government and generally anti-Semitism share those beliefs with certain militant Islamic fundamentalist groups, both the anti-U.S. attitudes and the anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish attitudes, so that there is a political affinity there. So it's not impossible that the terrorism attacks of September 11th might prompt a sympathetic response in the most extreme wing of the neo-Nazi movement.
When asked about this, Harris says the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Pure Christians have no quarrel at all with the Muslims, not in the least. And again, the Muslims are saying, get out of our country and leave us alone. The Christians are saying, get out of our country and leave us alone.
As for the actual anthrax letters that have killed several people, Chip Berlay says it's possible someone on the right might be playing copycat after September 11th.
The extreme right could easily have set up a copycat operation using anthrax that they could have obtained through a variety of sources. But the fact is, we don't know. There's a whole list of suspects that are out there.
Anthrax aside, Berlay says some on the Christian right see the terrorism attacks as God's punishment. According to Eric Ward of the Northwest Coalition for Human Dignity, there's a split on the right in the wake of the World Trade Center attacks. Ward says the reactionary right is promoting anti-Arab as well as anti-immigrant sentiment.
The white nationalist movement, however, has made a very distinct move away from Middle America. And one is celebrating the explosions and the terrorist attack that occurred. Two, blaming Jews and Israel for it. Three, launching a heavy anti-immigration rhetoric, and four, talking about attempting to move into actually the anti-war and peace movements.
On the last point, Ward says this is because the white nationalist movement has moved from reactionary to revolutionary.
It wants to see the fall of the U.S. system and government and opposes multinational capitalism and opposes also U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And in that way, they see opportunities for potential crossover into the liberal and left movement, hopefully to for them to attempt recruitment.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Spokane, Washington.
The Pentagon says U.S. bombs are targeting a complex system of caves in the north believed to be used as hideouts for Osama bin Laden. According to the Associated Press, 13 civilians were killed Sunday by U.S. missiles. This, as Senator John McCain of Arizona and others, including opposition rebels in Afghanistan, pressure the Bush administration to send in the ground troops. Taliban forces, meanwhile, report they have arrested Americans but have not said how many or who they are. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Fariba Nawa is in Peshawar, Pakistan, where she's been in contact with military sources on both sides of the war. We asked her how the Taliban is responding to reports of U.S. ground troops being sent in.
The overall sentiment here is that the United States is not reaching any of its objectives so far with airstrikes in the Northern Alliance. And that's why the Bush administration is being pressured to deploy those ground troops. As far as the Taliban are concerned, they want to show that they're more powerful on the ground, even though they have basically held very strong to their front lines so far. It's been 3 weeks now, and we were expecting them to lose a lot of territory and the Northern Alliance to take that territory, but that hasn't happened yet, apart from a few successes here and there. The Taliban is still very much ruling Afghanistan. And once the ground troops go in, they will be able to show, I think this is what they think, how much power they have in Afghanistan.
We heard reports over the weekend that Muslims, extremist Muslims, killed a number of Christians.
Those reports are really disturbing. The Christian community in Pakistan is the poorest, and they're subjected to a lot of oppression here, and they have been the lower caste, shall we say, and it's easy to target them. They're very peaceful people. They keep out of everybody's way. They don't have any movement asking for rights, or as far as I know. It's not a very large population. It's quite small. They were attacked, and the reports say that the attack was linked to the Afghan war. I think that the people who killed them assume that they are aligned with the United States because of Christianity. Now, whether that's true or not doesn't really matter. I think right now anybody who is not Muslim and not pro-Taliban can be targeted easily. On the other hand, Mullah Omar had called for another demonstration in Quetta, and usually 10,000 to 15,000 people show up when there's such a call. Today only 4,000 showed up.
Fariba, we're hearing some reports about a number of Pakistanis who are just sort of poised and waiting to be invited in by the Taliban. What can you tell us about that?
There are about 10,000 tribal soldiers from the tribal area, an area that Pakistan government does not have any control over, that have armed themselves and ready to go in and fight with the Taliban against the United States and against the Northern Alliance. However, the Taliban have told them to stay put for several reasons, I think. One is because these people don't have the means to support themselves. They're going to become a burden on the Taliban in terms of food, housing. And secondly, I think the Taliban are afraid of infiltrators. There might be spies among them. And perhaps they don't have a need for them right now because they have quite a few soldiers there already, Arab volunteers and Pakistani volunteers who've gone in to fight. These men are just waiting at the border with their guns. They're just sitting there waiting to see what's going to happen with these guys.
Free Speech Radio news correspondent Fariba Nawa spoke with us from Peshawar, Pakistan. As U.S. warplanes rain bombs down on Afghanistan, the enemy in America's last war stands trial at The Hague. Today, former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic refused to plead guilty or not guilty to charges against him. And in an interesting development, the independent lawyers appointed by the court to present Milosevic's case have challenged the judges to validate the tribunal's jurisdiction. Geraldine Coughlin reports from The Hague.
Slobodan Milosevic lived up to expectations and obstinately refused to plead to charges against him, claiming the evidence is false and interrupting Judge Richard May.
In the event of your not entering a plea, the trial chamber has a power to enter a plea of not guilty. That we will do. You will have an opportunity, as you know quite well, Mr. Milosevic, to address us at other times.
The new charges in the Kosovo indictment and the new indictment covering war crimes in Croatia accuse Milosevic of the ethnic cleansing of Kosovar Albanians, Croats and other non-Serbs in his bid to build a greater Serbia during the 1990s. Milosevic claims he's being given an unfair trial by a political court that's biased against him. The Amici Curiae, the three lawyers making representations on his behalf, want to put the legitimacy of the court to the test and advise the judges to seek the opinion of the UN's highest legal body, the World Court, on the validity of the tribunal. One of the Amici Curiae, or Friends of the Court, Stephen Kay, said the court shouldn't rule on its own competence. This, he said, should be subject to the expert opinion of the International Court of Justice.
One of the key fundamental principles for any valid court of law is the principle of impartiality. Without that, there can be no rule of law and no right to a fair trial. And the proposition that for this court to be validated, it should be validated by a principal organ of the UN, being the International Court of Justice, that this issue of impartiality is very much bound up within the validation of the tribunal.
But Milosevic doesn't appreciate the Amici Curiae's efforts to promote his case. He said he didn't appoint them or a defense counsel, and that he chose to defend himself in court. Earlier in the proceedings, the judge gave Milosevic the chance to speak.
Pre svega, ja ne podnosim nikakve podneske ovom sudu zbog toga što...
In calm, clear tones, he said the Kosovo indictment against him was false and that during the conflict he'd only been defending his nation and protecting the Yugoslav people from what he called terrorism. Slobodan Milosevic sees himself as the victim of what he ironically terms Hague fair play. The judges and the Amici Curiae are on the same side, he says, and it's they who'll be pulling the strings at the status conference on the Milosevic case on Tuesday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin at The Hague.
Palestinians handed out sweets in the rubble-strewn streets of Bethlehem as Israeli tanks rumbled out of the Palestinian town, marking the beginning of the end of a 10-day invasion that left swatches of the town gutted and some 20 people dead. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, under rising pressure from the U.S. to end the bloody standoff, ordered his heavy armor and troops out despite the killings of five Israelis in two attacks in northern Israel. An Israeli military meeting was scheduled for today to discuss Israel's withdrawing from five other towns it steamrolled into out of revenge for the assassination of Tourism Minister Rahavam Zivi by Palestinian hardliners. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft is in Ramallah. He spoke with Tufik Haddad, editor of the Israeli-Palestinian publication Between the Lines. Kraft asked Haddad about the future of the year-old intifada, which has left over 1,000 people dead.
The Zaevi assassination provided Israel this sort of internal consensus to take the Israeli repression of the intifada up a level and to try and teach the Palestinians a lesson, so to speak, in the newfound bipolar world of good civilization and justice versus terrorism. And so Sharon is really trying to position Israel and what it does within the same camp as what America is supposedly doing in Afghanistan.
Where is Yasser Arafat standing today in front of his people and in front of the armed factions?
With the increase of Israeli repressive measures against the people, it becomes increasingly difficult for Arafat to impose control against these armed elements of the Palestinian masses, because their legitimacy rises and their role and importance in protecting and defending the people rises when Israel takes on these repressive policies.
Does this mean that PFLP, PPP, Hamas, Islamic Jihad have more popularity among the Palestinian street than the Palestinian National Authority?
The division is more clearly along the lines of who is loyal to Palestinian national rights and is willing to fight for them, and who is willing to compromise on them. These people have gained full legitimacy throughout the Intifada, and at the same time, there has been the marginalization of the streams and elements within the Palestinian national makeup that were pro-Oslo.
Is there any strategy behind the way the Intifada is conducted?
It has many contradictions in it. I don't think the Intifada has necessarily demonstrated a clear strategy vis-a-vis its resistance at all. There is the resolution to resist, but there is no resolution about how to resist and what to resist and what's off-bounds and what's not off-bounds and what are we trying to accomplish and what can we accomplish and what can't we accomplish. Unfortunately, Palestinians lack a forum to do this in. They lack the mechanisms to do this in because there has not been decent mobilization or creation of democratic mechanisms and forums of communication. Not to mention, of course, I mean the sheer geopolitical reality where each city is an independent island that's separated from each other, and is determined by the political situation in each city is determined by what's on the ground in each community. So this is very much how Israel designed the Oslo process and the division of the Palestinian territory, occupied territories, so that it could be more easy to control.
Israeli have gained a sort of legitimacy in entering autonomous area of the Palestinian Authority. Where will this lead?
What we witnessed throughout the last 10 days was the killing of 55 Palestinians, and not one Israeli was killed during that whole period. The problem is an international one, and the international community really has to step up to the challenge, but they haven't historically, and they're much more interested in pursuing the negotiated track, which of course gives preference to the stronger party, in this case Israel, and preserves the status quo. And that's the sad and tragic reality that we're in, and the Intifada is an attempt to at least resist that.
The situation remains tense in the western Indian state of Maharashtra, where violence broke out Friday after police prevented a group of Muslims from distributing leaflets urging people to boycott U.S.-made goods. 12 people have died so far in police shootings. The army has sealed off the town, and in Melgaon, over 137 people have been arrested. Hindus have alleged their shops and houses have been attacked and set on fire. Samat, one of India's leading cultural activist groups, organized a sit-in in the Indian capital this past weekend to protest the U.S.-led war against Afghanistan. The cultural sit-in brought together scores of people, young and old, intellectuals, poets, and artists, to add their voices to the peace movement that is gaining momentum in the country. Sputnik Kalambi reports from New Delhi.
The crowd may not have been as large as the organizers wished, but the message certainly came through loud and clear. America's war against Afghanistan is unjust and wrong, and that despite attempts to portray anti-war feeling as being restricted to Muslim public opinion, opposition to the war is widespread and cuts across religion in India. Shabnam Hashmi is one of the founders of Sehmat, a cultural activist group set up after the murder of her brother Safdar Hashmi in the late 80s. He was a talented and outspoken artist who used street theatre to raise political awareness amongst the poor and underprivileged. Since its creation, Sehmat has been in the forefront of campaigns to promote communal harmony in India.
We feel that war is not the answer. There is no way that you can finish either terrorism or, what is US doing? It's ultimately killing the innocent people in Afghanistan. Today's protest is a cultural protest by the artists of India against the US aggression in Afghanistan. We are here to register protest through creative ways. We want our voice heard.
And this obviously comes at a time when increasingly any kind of criticism of the United States is being seen here as anti-national.
Yes, which is very alarming because 2 days ago, three students who were just distributing leaflets against the war, they were arrested by the police. I said, we'll challenge them. Let them come and arrest us if they think that what we are doing is anti-national.
We, the students of Springdale School, Dhola Kuan, would like to add our voices to those around the world who seek and believe in peace. We stand for the indomitable urge of justice, dignity, and peace.
Poets, cinema and stage actors, academics and musicians dared the government to describe their protest as anti-national. The Indian government may have endorsed the so-called war against terrorism, but for those gathered here, the carpet bombing of Afghanistan is an imperialist war.
When it is said by Bush, either you are with us or you are against us, he is mirroring exactly what is said by the terrorists. Not only is it the case they share exactly the same mindset, but they actually feed on one another. I oppose this war so that in opposing this war, we create the conditions for a struggle, a global struggle, both against terrorism and against US imperialism. Thank you.
Well-known academic Prabhat Patnaik. The media presence was unusually strong at the cultural sit-in. A welcome change, says Sehmat activist Rajendra Prasad.
Media itself is biased. Media is biased in the sense, in as far as all this reporting is concerned. For example, they would not report the kind of activity that we are doing, and they would be more than willing to report or go out of their way to report the kind of disruptive activities that are taking place by the extremist elements from both sides of in both the communities.
The energy is there, but it has yet to translate into sizable numbers in the streets. A big peace rally is planned for the end of the month, and activist and poet Gohar Raza is hopeful. The peace movement, he says, has come a long way since the 1980s.
And at that time, a lot of people, and young ones especially, who saw my presentation and who heard my lectures during Janvigyan Jatha, they came and asked us that what can we do? And at that time, I was at loss. I just couldn't answer them that where to go, how to oppose, because there were no organizations taking up these issues. But today the good thing is that a lot of organizations have come up. People are getting together today who are saying no more war. The number is growing larger and larger.
Imagine all the people living life in peace.
Sputnik Kilambi in New Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.